You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Chris Nichols. Back in 2023, CAP Radio released a new podcast that aimed to put listeners in the shoes of everyday people at the center of issues often overlooked or politicized by society. This Is What It Feels Like is hosted by Tara Lopez and explores issues such as abortion and the effects of catcalling. Tara just returned from London, where she accepted an award on the podcast's behalf from the International Women's Podcasting Festival, first runner-up in the category A Moment of Touching Honesty. That comes on the heels of This Is What It Feels Like being named Best Interview Podcast by the Public Media Journalists Association in June. This week, we're going to hear highlights from some of the episodes honored, starting at the beginning with Episode 1, Navigating the U.S. Healthcare System as a Trans Person. Tara picks up the story from here.
Everyone's experience is different, but I think the overall end goal is the same. Folks just want to feel seen and be heard. You're going to hear from three people, Eliza, Romeo, and Machu. They're going to share their journeys with us, realizations, obstacles they came across, and the risks they took as they continue down a path to embracing their best selves. This is what it feels like to navigate the United States healthcare system as a trans person. I met Eliza for the first time in her apartment. Immediately, I was greeted with hugs, snacks, and her infectious laugh.
My name is Eliza Claiborne Crosby, and I live in Yuba City, California.
Eliza was born in Vallejo, California, and moved all over Northern California as a kid.
The beginning of my childhood was, I guess you would say, idyllic. My parents were together. We had a very strong unit. It was just, I guess, the ideal family life.
She knew she was different at an early age. She didn't connect with her dad and brothers. She didn't like sports. Instead, she says that she loved hanging out with her mom, cooking, cleaning, and hanging around her mom's girlfriends.
I was just in awe of them. And as soon as they came over, I would try to plan their hair and fill on their clothes. And my mom would be like, go somewhere and play, you know. But I always remember looking at them, thinking to myself as a kid, maybe four-ish, thinking to myself like, oh my God, that's what I'm going to be when I get older, or that's who I am. My feeling was that of a little girl. I felt that when people would call me he and stuff like that, it was kind of like a cringe for me, or it would kind of be like, don't you see what I see? It was my heart. It was in my brain. It was enriched in me. And as I got older, 8, 9, 10, when you're in elementary school and, you know, like the boys are chasing the girls. Honey, the boys were chasing me too, honey. So there was a...
Romeo Augustine, older than 35, Denver, Colorado.
I flew out to see Romeo at the house he just bought with his partner in a suburb near Denver. Romeo is from my hometown, a neighborhood actually. We both grew up in South Sacramento, and we've been friends for over a decade. Romeo grew up with his mom, two older sisters, and younger brother. He tells me, like Eliza, he also felt different at a young age.
I always had this other, like, independent way of like, I'm gonna be who I'm gonna be, and I'm gonna be exactly who I'm gonna be, and it's not about being a boy or a girl. It was like, I'm original, and that was like 100% how I thought of it, because I didn't have any language that there were other queer people who felt not connected to their body in this way. So I always made it about for myself and in my mind and how I thought about it. And when I knew that I wasn't like, quote unquote, the other girls, that I resulted in me just like, I am me. I am my original self. I feel so grateful for the love my mother instilled in us. Whether we were like dirt ass poor or doing okay, we were like beautiful and lovely. And I wasn't willing to accept that because I didn't feel the same, it made me less than.
When Romeo was 13, he was confronted about his sexuality for the first time by a friend at school.
She was like, bisexual? And I was like, nah, not at all. Turns out it was so much more than just being good old-fashioned gay.
Romeo says that he didn't really know what to think in that moment because he didn't know any queer folks. No one around him was gay, but he did have a family friend named Jimbo.
And he like taught me so much things to like fashion and how I put things in my closet. And no one ever told us he was gay. We didn't understand he was gay. But when we were 16 and we got pulled into the hospital because he was dying of AIDS, is when it clicked to me that he was gay. Mm. And as a kid, he was just like the most fierce, lovely, like be who he was, human being. And I didn't even realize he was gay until I was well into being a teenager and realizing like what was all associated with his death. And that was one of the pivotal moments in understanding. I wanted to know what it was, every aspect of being queer.
My name is Machu. I'm 31 years old, and I currently live in Sacramento, California.
Machu and I have been friends for nearly 15 years. And even though we've seen each other through a lot, we had never really talked about his journey with recently transitioning. So he came over to my place one afternoon and sat down with me and told me that he also knew as a child that he was different.
I knew that I was like definitely queer and felt like I was born into the wrong body at a very early age, probably like as far back as I can remember, maybe even as young as 3 or earlier. And so I feel like a lot of my childhood was like very confusing for that part, being as young as like 5 and the language that I had at the time, you know, saying like, I wish I was a boy or I want to wear like boy clothes or I have a crush on my best friend or like I'm in love with Posh Spice, you know, and like any way that I could like express these things that were like not the norm, but it was never taken seriously. I realized that I was very depressed, you know, even as young as 10, where I felt almost like suicidal because I felt like at the time would never be fully accepted for who I was because everyone around me wasn't aware of how to be anything other than, you know, the binary or just the cultural norm in every sense. And so I didn't think a lot of things that would be possible. Like the life that I wanted to live, the person that I want to become, felt so out of reach.
What struck me the most was that all three of them knew they were different at such a young age. They didn't quite know what that meant necessarily or how to express it, but the feeling was there. Four years after Eliza's mom asked her if she was gay, she started having feelings for boys. She was 16, and this was the very early 90s, when she felt like she still had to hide. So Eliza tells me that she would secretly experiment with her appearance when she was alone.
And I started doing little things like invisible makeup. Like you.
What is that? I've never heard invisible
makeup. Invisible makeup is like little things that I taught myself to enhance what I thought was very feminine about me, like my eyes. And I would go in the bathroom and spend hours just putting on eyeliner, you know, on my lips, just so that I can feel that connection. Because when I looked at myself in the mirror, I seen her. Mm-hmm. But when I walked out of the bathroom, I couldn't bring her out. You know, she had to stay in there.
Eliza towed the line of androgyny, but the real turning point for her came when a friend at school asked her if she could put makeup on her.
And I was like, no, I can't do that. She goes, Eliza, you are a girl. Everyone says that. Wow. You know what I'm saying? And so
how did that feel?
Her affirming me?
Yes.
Oh my God. It was like, you know how when you're a kid and someone goes peekaboo and you see something and then they take it away. Then you see it again and they take it away. It was like that. Like she was able to see inside of me. And then she wasn't. And then when she put the makeup on me, and it was like, oh my God, girl. It was emotional for the both of us.
Eliza had gotten her first glimpse, and she couldn't unsee that person. She knew she had to leave.
I'm out of here. I'm not going to die in Marysville, Yuba City, California. I'm going to LA, and I'm going to become a star, honey.
So Eliza moved to LA with big dreams. But reality soon set in when she discovered that the streets of downtown LA were not that glamorous. But even though the overall experience didn't quite match up with her high hopes, she says that the move was transformational and that she met a woman that would change her life.
And I was like, oh my God, I love your hair. And when I did that, she turned around and she smiled at me. And then she goes, you know, I'm TS. Back then it was TS, transsexual. And I said, TS? I'm like, what is a TS? And she said, I wasn't born a girl. And my whole mouth just dropped because the moment she said that, I knew that that was me. I had a connection for the first time to somebody that was me. Yes, I connected with my mom. I connected with my sisters. I connected with the beautiful girlfriends that my mom had. But I had never connected with somebody who was exactly like me. And that's when I was able to put a name to the face of me. That is the beginning of my journey as a Black trans woman.
As Eliza was discovering new possibilities and identity, Romeo was starting to question his own sexuality when he was 16.
And you go through all the phases, like, I'm bi-curious. I'm just curious. I'm bisexual. Okay, I'm a lesbian. I'm a gender non-conforming. You know, you like, but A, in your heart, be who you are. And you should change.
And who were you in your heart?
So I didn't know I could want to be another gender until I saw it online at some point. I just didn't know it was allowed. And so I think I started finding out like 16, 17. I asked to be called another name. I definitely felt like on the masculine spectrum of things, I felt my most comfortable. But I'll be honest, like it didn't aha moment until I went through this art project of like a 21-year-old becoming a drag king with multiple friends and these older women who were queer women in the community of the town I lived in. And then having that moment and like feeling 100% whole, it like broke a light through the glass that you could never pull the shades down on after that moment.
Can you walk us through that aha moment, that epiphany that you had?
Just getting dressed up and then we put facial hair on and we bound our chest and like... The first time I ever bound my chest and didn't want to have that, like, really recognize in my body, I was willing to, like, be in pain for hours for, like, ace bandage wraps at the time before I could afford binders. And I would choose pain over breasts. It was all epiphanies and waves for me because I didn't have language to connect to it at the time. But it was always just, like, a feeling in my belly. And then once you learned about it, it was like, tell me more, you know?
Machu's experience was similar. but also different. He says he was a late bloomer and that he didn't really feel comfortable dating until he was around 16. He says that he felt fully accepted by his friends and the kids at school to embrace his androgyny, so he did. But even though it was 2006 and perceptions on gender had evolved, Machu was still really confused.
Getting closer to my 20s, I started trying to embrace, like, being more feminine, you know, letting my hair grow really long, wearing more tight-fitting clothing. I definitely tried to embrace, like, okay, this is the body that I was born into. Like, let me decide and see if I can make the most of it. And it got to the point where there was almost, like, too much attention. And so at a certain point, I just, like, shaved my head. One, it's annoying to be just, like, harassed, but it could also be life or death, you know, refusing someone's offer or not smiling or saying hello. And so it was, you know, going back to even my thoughts as, like, an 8-year-old and being almost afraid to, like, blossom into, like, a feminine person. At a certain point, I just had enough.
Just as Eliza was beginning to learn more about her transness, she had to move back home to Yuba City to care for her mother. There were no other trans girls around, but she did find herself living vicariously through her best friend.
She was very tomboyish, and she was so beautiful, tall, and I would dress her down, honey. But she never wanted to dress like that, so she wanted to be rough and tough, right? So this one year, I said, I'm going to do it. And I said, I want to wear these shorts. I want to wear this shirt. By this time, I still hadn't really dressed the part. But this day I did.
Her entire family was gathering at a local park.
We got out the car. And if you could have seen the park, it was like every eye in the park just zoomed on me. And I took so much heat that day. My brother came up to me and was like, what the hell are you doing? My uncle came up to me and he was absolutely furious. It was the best feeling in the whole wide world. Oh my God, I felt so empowered. Oh my God, I felt like I was giving the middle finger to every last person in that park who ever laughed at me, who ever said something under their breath at me. I mean, it was just the best feeling in the world. And from that day forward, I have not looked back.
After spending years of struggling with his identity, Machu began HRT, hormone replacement therapy, when he was 29. He went to the Gender Health Center in Sacramento, where they helped him navigate the process.
I kept having to remind myself and also, like, take the advice of others that, like, don't expect anything immediately. You know, you might not see any real changes until or after, like, 3 months. And I was overly eager, like, every day, like, recording my voice to notice any changes or look in the mirror. And I'm like, I still look kind of the same, you know?
Machu says that starting HRT actually brought up a lot more dysphoria for him. He felt inadequate, not masculine enough, and was worried that he wouldn't ever feel comfortable in his body. So he started looking into next steps. He got a letter of recommendation from his therapist for top surgery, but was quickly denied by his insurance provider.
It was just like going in circles, honestly, and was a lengthy process in itself where I kind of just gave up, where I was like, I don't feel like calling and being on hold for an hour and getting transferred to this person or not having any clear answers or having to wait in the mail for the mail. I didn't have capacity at the time. So I said, you know, it's fine. Like, I'll just attempt it at another time.
Over the next 7 years, Romeo had to also navigate the healthcare system in order to get approved for his top surgery. He passed every single screening and psychological test with flying colors, but he also had to get a letter of recommendation from his therapist. It was there where his therapist broke the news to him that he wouldn't be able to get top surgery due to where he fell on the BMI chart, a system used by doctors to classify your weight and height. Hold on, so she was the one to tell you that news, not your doctor?
Not my doctor.
And did she tell you this after
the test? After the test. So, like, after she was like, you're definitely getting my letter of recommendation, I just have to be transparent with you that I know it's going to come up. She knows she was breaking bad news to me. She was like, your BMI is too high. I don't know if you're going to clear with the surgeon. So, sure enough, like, I have an appointment with the surgeon within days of that clearance appointment. And she, like, literally looked me up and down and was like, you got to lose 100 pounds and come back.
100 pounds.
100 pounds.
How did you feel in that moment?
I was, like, so sad after that. Honestly, yo, I did some dumb crash diets and, like, started eating as little as possible and, like, being super unhealthy in that way. And then that went into, like, straight up benders. Like, I worked in high-end hospitality. All my friends are bartenders. If you're sad and in your body and, like, binding until your underarms bleed and you have insurance to cover a procedure that could save your being, you're just kind of like, F it. And that's what it went. It was like, cool, I can't do this. We'll party. Mm-hmm. And I partied hard for a year plus.
For the next 5 years, Romeo says that he did a ton of research on doctors, trying to find someone who would say yes to performing his top surgery, despite what his BMI numbers showed. He found her, Dr. Gallagher, who's now based in Miami, Florida, and has been performing gender-confirming surgeries on larger-bodied folks for years at her practice, Gallagher Plastic Surgery. So, Romeo flew across the country in the summer of 2020. You go into the office, day of surgery. How are you feeling?
Nervous, excitement, fantastic, worried. Like, I'm in a different state. I have to fly home right after this. Like, I'm using all my money for this.
After nearly a decade of waiting, Romeo finally had his top surgery.
It's so cliche, but, like, literally and figuratively, a weight was lifted off of my shoulders. And it was, like, yo, like, it was so whole. It felt so, like, if you ever had a bunch of wonder in your soul or in your heart or in your thoughts, like, ah, oh, just wonder. All of my wonder was taken away, and it created so much space for me to put stuff that I didn't have to wonder about in there.
It created more room for you.
Literally more capacity in the human that I was possible to be was created and provided space for that in comfort of, like, loving myself and being the person that I was, knew I always was.
Being denied top surgery was also crushing to Machu. So in 2020, he decided to go travel to Turkey with his then partner to try to clear his head.
And that's where I ended up having my top surgery with no qualms whatsoever, no questions asked.
The plan was that he was only going to be in Turkey for a couple of weeks. But then the pandemic happened, and they found themselves in Turkey for 10 months. One night while at a friend's apartment, they started talking about top surgery. And after hearing about his ordeal over in the States, Machu's friend made a phone call. And within minutes, Machu had an appointment for a consultation.
And the guy's looking at me and looking at my chest, and he's like, when do you want to do it? And I was like, when can we? I'm thinking, like, months, you know, a while. He's like, come next week.
Oh. Within 2 weeks, Machu raised the funds needed for his top surgery. He says that it cost him around $1,300. The average cost for the exact same procedure in the U.S. can range anywhere from $10,000 to $15,000, sometimes even more. But looking beyond the physical transitioning, he says that he's had to navigate the social transitioning aspects too, especially when it comes to his immediate family.
I feel like I've had an easier time socially transitioning with newer people in my life, friends, acquaintances, strangers. When it comes to family and the people that have known me since I was little and pre-transitioning, it's been really hard.
How so?
You know, they still call me by my dead name, refer to me as Miha, she, etc. And it makes it really hard to like want to interact with them or be around them. But yeah, socially transitioning, because you can be trans and never do HRT and never do surgery. Like those people's experience are completely valid. Their wants and desires are completely valid. You can have a beard and still want to be like, you know, feminine or non-binary. No one really has to do all the things that people think that they should do in order to be trans.
That was host Tara Lopez exploring the experience of receiving gender-affirming care in the United States. This week, we'll listen back to some of our favorite episodes of This Is What It Feels Like, which you can find wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks again for joining us. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. If you want to join the conversation, email us at insight@capradio.org. Thank you to producer Sarit Leshinsky and Jen Picard. Our digital producer is Chris Feltz. Insight's technical director and audio engineer is Mark Jones. Our original show music is produced by Adrian Gilmore. I'm Chris Nichols, in for Vicky Gonzalez. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.